In the coming week, Moscow reacts to a court ruling on a journalist who protested Russia's invasion of Ukraine. China celebrates the founding of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, and the UN hosts a review conference on the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's July 28th and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob McMahon is away today. Filling in for him is Carla Ann Robbins, a senior fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as faculty director of the Masters of International Affairs program at the Marx School at Baruch College. Carla, thanks for joining me.
Jim, thank you so much for having me back.
Carla, let's kick off this week's discussion by talking about Marina Osvinnikova, a journalist who worked for a Russian state television channel. She was arrested back in March after coming on the set of a live evening newscast holding a sign with an anti-war message. A court heard her case today and handed down a ruling. First, what did the court decide? But more broadly, what is the significance of the case?
So actually, Jim, so she was convicted for something else that she did. She was convicted for discrediting the country's armed forces for a more recent action, posting on social media her one-woman protest in mid-July in front of the Kremlin, in which she unfurled a poster with the inscription, "Putin is a murderer, his soldiers are fascists," with photos of children killed in Ukraine. And the judge said the court was fining her 50,000 rubles, which is $822, for her social media posts. And her story really is a much more complicated one. You know, she was a longtime editor for Russia's state-run channel One TV, and I gather her job was to watch Western news and look for stories that made us look bad. So she was in the propaganda business. And in the thing for which she is best known is in mid-March, she came on the set of this nightly news show, Vremya, holding a poster, and she's really into posters in Russian and English, which said, "Stop the war, don't believe the propaganda." And she was, you know, screamed out, "Stop the war, no to war, stop the war, no to war." And this went utterly viral. And at the time, she was detained, questioned, and for that, she got off even more lightly than she got off today. She got off with an administrative punishment, you know, related to something even different, an anti-war video she had posted on social media, not even for rushing the Vremya set. And rather than criminal charges of that time for the TV protest, she got a fine of 30,000 rubles, which was $300 at that time. And she could have gotten a 15-year prison sentence, but she didn't. She was also allowed to speak to Western media. She was allowed to leave the country and now come back, which is she had just returned when she went and made the second protest. And all of this raised suspicions that she is somehow in the pocket of the government, something that she insists is not true. I have no idea. I have no idea. Raising this makes me uncomfortable. But she says it's part of Putin's brilliant head games to discredit her. She was hired very briefly by a German newspaper to cover Ukraine, but she drew so much hostility there from Ukrainians, and that's why I'm raising this, who claimed that she was, you know, in Putin's pockets, that she couldn't stay there very long. So now she's back in Russia to get custody of her kids and doing this latest protest. So this is, you know, a very complicated and confusing story. But beyond her case, you know, we need to remember exactly how dangerous a place Russia under Putin is for journalists. You know, since he took over in January of 2000, the Committee to Protect Journalists says that at least 25 journalists have been killed for doing their job. The number may be much, much higher. And since just this most recent invasion of Ukraine, Putin has taken even more steps to shut down all of the remaining independent media, to outlaw free expression, even banning calling what's happening in Ukraine a war. You know, Novaya Gazeta shut down, Echo of Moscow shut down. Hundreds of journalists have been forced to leave the country. You know, there is still independent media people working on Telegram, but this is a very, very dangerous place to tell the truth, Jim.
Well, Carla, I didn't mention this in the lead-in to our discussion, but you are a longtime foreign correspondent. Can you just talk to us from your personal experience about how it is to try to report the news in countries where there are officials seeking to prevent you from doing just that?
Well, I would say, you know, more than anything else is that we as American journalists usually have it hell of a lot easier than the local reporters do. And we very often rely on local reporters to let us know what's going on. And in part, you know, people want us to get out the truth because they can't get out the truth. And so, you know, we have this incredible sense of solidarity with them. How do we work? I will, you know, a lot of American news organizations, including the New York Times, with which I used to work, pulled out their reporters when they first, you know, passed this new law banning, you know, people from telling the truth about what was happening in Ukraine. Most everybody's gone back, but it's very, very challenging to work under these circumstances. And it's become infinitely more dangerous, you know, since journalists have become targeted since, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. But even in places like Russia, you worry about your own security, but more than anything else, you worry about the security of the people who work with you, whether they are your local hires, you know, the people who work in your offices, and certainly the people who talk to you, your sources. And, you know, Russia is a very, very scary place right now.
There's been a lot of coverage in the news recently about the arrest of the WNBA star Brittany Griner, now talk that perhaps she'll be released as part of a prisoner exchange deal. Is there a concern among journalists when you're in a hostile country that you may be arrested on trumped up charges and held by the government to be used as a bargaining chip to extract concessions from other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly. I mean, I think the days in which we used to think that we were untouchable are long gone. And you know, those days disappeared for me when Danny Pearl was killed.
Danny Pearl was a Wall Street Journal reporter who was killed in Pakistan.
Yes. And I was working with the Journal in those days. And I think that up until then, I certainly felt that we somehow had this force field around us because we were American journalists. And that certainly isn't true. Being used as a bargaining chip, that has happened in the past. I mean, Brittany Griner, you would think would be totally non-political, totally off limits. And here she is, you know, being held, and someone who was quite popular in Russia as well. And we're, you know, enormous amount of support from sports figures inside of Russia. And, you know, this is what happens in circumstances like this. And I think it's very valiant that all these reporters are back in there and they're back in there doing their jobs. But more than anything else, I think when you go in there as a reporter, you know, and if you work for a, quote, mainstream news organizations like I have worked for, you have a lot of protection, usually not guaranteed protection. And you look at what happened with Danny, but you have a lot of protection. You have people who train you in security. You've got security around where you work. But the people who work with you and your sources, you worry about them all the time.
Sounds very stressful.
Stressful, challenging, interesting, like all good jobs. Jim, I'd like to take our conversation over to China, another place where it's very dangerous to work as a journalist, where the Chinese People's Liberation Army is set to celebrate its 95th anniversary on Monday. This is taking place at a time of growing tensions between the U.S. and China, especially over Taiwan. Jim, how tense are things, and what is Nancy Pelosi thinking?
Well, we'll get to Nancy Pelosi in a second, Carla. Let's just begin with the issue of tensions, and I would say things are very tense. Nick Burns, who's the U.S. ambassador to China, said back in June that U.S.-China relations are at their lowest moment since diplomatic relations resumed in 1972. Eli Ratner, who is a former senior fellow here at the Council, who is now Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Affairs, warned this week of an unprecedented spike in what he called direct, aggressive, unsafe behavior by China in the South China Sea. We have seen over the last several months an increase in Chinese incursions into Taiwan's air defense identification zone, and also crossing the so-called median line in the Taiwan Strait between mainland China and Taiwan. All of these developments are concerning, and they reflect both growing capabilities on China's part, but also long-standing grievances. On the capabilities side, China now has the world's second largest defense budget. It has been investing heavily as its economy has grown. No real surprise there. We've seen all rising powers do pretty much the same. It now is gaining a blue water navy capable of sailing well beyond China's shores. They have improved their fighter capacity as well as developing an array of ballistic missiles. I will note a lot of this technology was stolen from the United States and from other countries. And I would imagine that when the PLA, which refers not just to the army itself, but the entire military forces of China, when the PLA celebrates its 95th birthday on Monday, you'll see some of that hardware being paraded. Now, when we talk about grievances, Taiwan comes to the top of the list. President Xi has made it very clear that he intends to reunify Taiwan with the mainland during his presidency. China also wants to assert control over the South China Sea. It claims that the South China Sea, which in many parts is quite a long ways from the Chinese mainland, is nonetheless Chinese territory. That is a view disputed by most other countries. And again, this is where we get into the Pelosi trip, with tensions already rising over Taiwan, in part because of comments that President Biden has made during his presidency, suggesting that the United States will come to the aid of Taiwan if it is attacked by China, thereby overturning a longstanding policy of strategic ambiguity. You have Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi indicating that she is going to travel in August to Taiwan. The Chinese apparently have made it very clear through diplomatic channels that they view this as quite hostile. And the description we see in news reports is that the way in which the Chinese have communicated this to American officials and the tone is quite unlike anything that the United States has seen before. I should note that Speaker Pelosi has a long record of being critical of Beijing on a variety of issues, particularly on human rights. Many years ago, she was in Beijing and unveiled a sign protesting Chinese policies, which really annoyed the Chinese. There's a piece by Mike Chinoy in Foreign Policy, which talks about how Representative Pelosi, as she was at the time, then left, and the journalists who were covering her got harassed by Chinese officials, an experience I'm sure it resonates with you, Carla, given your long time as a diplomatic correspondent. Now, there's some effort to try to calm things down. President Biden and President Xi were supposed to have a conversation sometime today. May have already occurred or may happen later today when this podcast comes out, just given the time difference between Washington and Beijing. It is their fifth phone call, the first since March. And I think one of the things is to try to, in essence, ease tensions. I'm not really sure you're going to get any major breakthroughs from this conversation. What I will note is that, again, getting back to this issue of tensions, is that Xi himself is in a bit of a bind. This fall is a big time for him. We've talked often about how in October, he is set to break the tradition set by Deng Xiaoping and begin his third term as leader of China. But he's doing it in the midst of a slowing economy and growing public unrest. Now, that slowing economy is partly, maybe even to a great degree, the result of his own policies. This zero tolerance for COVID strategy simply does not work, has led to massive shutdowns, perhaps the most dramatic in Shanghai, where people were, in many cases, locked in their apartment buildings, whether they had enough food or water. And it's all because they're trying to prevent the spread of COVID. Chinese vaccines are only partially effective against some strains of COVID and apparently provide very little protection against the more dominant strains that have emerged recently. But Xi has simply doubled down on this strategy rather than changing course and trying to get both more Chinese vaccinated and to use more effective Western vaccines. And so with the economy sputtering in the midst of what should be the coronation of Xi for going forward, I think there's a lot of pressure on Xi. And like many other leaders under pressure, there's a great temptation to play the nationalism card, to show that he is willing to stand up to those countries that are trying to prevent China's rise in ascendance. So these are very, very difficult times.
So, Jim, I'm a little puzzled by Biden policy toward China. Even if you look at their, you know, they haven't released their national defense strategy, they've yet to release their national security strategy, but on the very meager 1.5 pages we got out of them, China was 1 in 3 out of 4 priorities. They describe it as a threat. They describe it as a challenge. Sometimes they say we'll compete with them. Sometimes they'll say, you know, they're the worst thing that ever happened to us. There's a certain fear that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy on all this. And then we say we want to cooperate with them on, you know, all these other things. We want to trade with them. We want to do climate with them. And we threaten them not to help the Russians. As far as I can tell, they didn't do a lot. They may have hid money for the Russians, but they haven't delivered military and all of that. Do they have a coherent China policy? And isn't this the time you'd want, particularly since we're face-to-face with the Russians and in a long-time Cold War with the Russians now, that you'd want to be chilling things out with the Chinese rather than cranking things up?
Well, the Biden administration, Carla, would certainly say that it has a coherent policy, and it would acknowledge all of what you said, that we have competing interests or conflicting interests. And I believe Secretary of State Blinken tried to summarize the Biden administration's approach to China as, we will cooperate with China where we can, we will compete with China where we should, and we will confront China where we must. And so there are a lot of tensions inherent in that sort of formulation. Now, I do think for the administration, it faces a challenge it had not anticipated back when Joe Biden took the oath of office in January 2021. They anticipated back then that they would have the luxury of focusing on China. And that is indeed one of the reasons why President Biden wanted the United States to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan, so we could concentrate on job number one, adapting to the reality of China, pushing back where we need be. But look where we are right now. We are in this clear great power competition with China, but now we face confrontation with Russia at the same time, trying to provide reassurance to our European allies that our word is good. That matters not just in Europe, but it matters for allies elsewhere, because even allies in East Asia are looking to see what the United States does, because that's going to interpret whether they think they can count on the United States or not. So big things happening there. And you also have this sort of backseat crisis that is looming, doesn't get the attention that it normally would, and that has to do with Iran. The Biden administration hoped to be able to strike a quick deal with the regime in Iran to reinstate the Iran nuclear deal. And we're now 18 months into the Biden administration, and it looks like the odds of that happening are pretty close to zero. So the Biden administration is in a situation in which it has more crises either happening or potentially happening than any administration wants. Because as you know, Carla, from having covered Washington a lot, time is limited, attention is limited, and it can be very difficult for any administration to deal with two crises, let alone potentially three, which I think seems to be the case with the administration. And I should note, there's then the existential or macro crisis, which is climate change, which is looming in the background, which the administration had hoped to make some progress in dealing with. And even with the news recently that Senator Manchin has signed on to a deal that will make some down payments on doing more on climate change, I think most people regard that as a small step relative to the steps that need to be taken to be able both to reduce the emission of heat-trapping gases here in the United States and to respond to or adapt to the changes in climate that are going to happen, regardless of whether we make rapid progress in reducing emissions.
Well, I will tell you that if I were still on the daily beat in Washington, the thing I would most want to know right now is I want to know who was charged with talking to Nancy Pelosi. Did they talk to her directly or did they do it aide to aide? And I really want to know how that conversation went.
Well, I think they're trying to communicate to Speaker Pelosi in a variety of ways. President Biden did a public event where he was asked about it, and he said the U.S. military doesn't think it's a good time for her to travel to Taiwan. I will note he didn't say, I think it's a bad time. He's just trying to, in essence, say this is about military advice. By the same token, there are a lot of people on Capitol Hill, both Democrats and Republicans, who are arguing that Nancy Pelosi has to go to Taiwan now precisely because it upsets the Chinese. And if it were the case that Speaker Pelosi were to pass on her trip, and I should note that she was scheduled to go to Taiwan earlier this year, but had to cancel it because of COVID, the fact that she would not go now and has been so talked about would embolden the Chinese, basically say the United States can be intimidated by rhetorical pressure, and hence it would be a very bad geopolitical move not to go. The obvious counterargument is that you are basically provoking the Chinese, and are you prepared for where they may go on the escalation ladder? So I think there are a lot of conversations going back and forth about whether there's some way to thread the needle. As you know, in diplomacy, people try to find a way to avoid having to deal with the difficult extremes. It's not at all clear that there is some neat way to navigate between these competing challenges. Do you have an idea, Carla?
Well, I think perhaps the most chilling thing about this is that the Pentagon, meanwhile, is already making plans about how they're going to get here and what sort of escorts they're going to have, and just in case that there is some attempt by the Chinese to force her, block her plane from going there. I mean, that would be really bad, and one would prefer that they wouldn't have to make choices like that.
Agreed, but I should note that even if this trip by Speaker Pelosi goes off without a hitch and the Chinese do nothing, that doesn't mean we're at the end of the story. It's quite likely the Chinese will find some way to express or show their displeasure down the road. Again, this takes us back to where we began this conversation. These are very tense times, and you have competing great powers who have conflicting interests and so far have demonstrated little inclination to want to find ways to settle those competing interests and competing claims. And this is where you can really be held hostage to chance. Small things could happen that nobody anticipates that could become or lead to bigger crises. But Carla, let's switch gears and go to New York and talk about the United Nations, which is set to begin the 10th review conference for the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. What can we expect from the meeting?
Sadly, not a lot.
I'm shocked.
The world has been reminded, you know, since the war in Ukraine began, since the invasion, with all of Putin's nuclear threats, you know, that these weapons are still a very clear and present danger. You know, I don't expect much to happen. I never expect much to happen at NPT review conferences beyond hand-wringing and finger-wagging, especially this time. You know, this treaty, like almost all treaties, work on consensus. So getting 191 states parties to agree to reform it, and it does need reforming, and if you want to get into the weeds, we can talk about that, is nigh unto impossible. You know, but even a strong commitment to moving arms control forward is not going to happen because of what's going on in Ukraine and because of this frozen relationship between the U.S. and Russia. That said, you know, the NPT itself is a very important treaty, which I would argue has had real, if limited, success. You know, the aim of it was to hold the number of nuclear armed forces, the number of nuclear armed states to 5. Today there are 9, with Iran on the doorstep, as you said. But this is still a lot fewer than the 20 or 30 that everybody was worried about in the 1960s. And it was also supposed to reduce and in some unspecified future eliminate nuclear weapons. And according to the Federation of American Scientists, I looked it up today, in 1988, there were 70,000 nuclear warheads in the world. And today, there are still 12,700. That's far too many, but it's many fewer. Of that 12,700, 9,400 are in military stockpiles. The other 3,000 plus are awaiting dismantlement. And of that 9,400, 3,730 are deployed with operational forces. That means they're on missiles or bombers, submarines. So there's a hell of a lot of them still out there, and all of which leads to this question of what happens to arms control in the world after Ukraine if the war ever ends. You know, we only have one remaining arms control agreement with the Russians, New START, and that's supposed to expire in 2026. And as I said, anyone who thought the nuclear weapons were an old story, this war is a reminder of both their horror and their potential, but also of their shielding power. You know, the U.S. is self-deterred for fear of getting into a direct fight with nuclear-armed Russia. Biden has said many times, we don't want World War III, and he's absolutely right. But given that, I'm not sure there will be any rush to give up any more of them. You know, Biden was once suspected to be the president who was going to push forward with this, cut back on the nuclear modernization budget, potentially, perhaps go down the road of saying, you know, this is the theology of arms control, but was going to change the language here, you know, that maybe sole use of nuclear weapons. And he was going to somehow downgrade the language so it didn't sound like, you know, nuclear weapons were both a, you know, dessert topping and a floor wax that could be used for everything. And he hasn't done any of those things. And the Congress, including, you know, the House, when it just approved the authorization of the defense bill, is maintaining one of the weapons that Biden wanted to kill off, left over from the Trump administration. So everybody's suddenly falling in love with nuclear weapons again, just at a period of time when we really should be cutting back on them because we've seen exactly how scary they are. So, Jim, I don't expect a lot out of this conference, but I think it's a reminder, as this war is, that nuclear weapons are out there and they can still bite us in a really scary way.
Oh, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Carla, and I think you put your finger on a very important issue, which is that much of the arms control regime that we built up during the Cold War has come apart. We simply have New START pretty much everything else has gone by the wayside. I did a wonderful conversation with Michael Crepon, who regrettably passed away earlier this month. We spoke on the President's Inbox, another CFR podcast, and we talked through some of the complexities of actually trying to resurrect the lessons of arms control for the 21st century. Because one of the big changes, the simple number of countries that now matter when you think about arms control, throughout the Cold War, it was a bilateral issue. It was the United States and the Soviet Union. The reason we had so many nuclear weapons was because two countries, the United States and the Soviet Union, built an insane amount of nuclear bombs and associated delivery vehicles. And one of the great achievements of arms control was to bring those numbers back down. But now we see the Pakistanis increasing the size of their nuclear arsenal. We are seeing the Iranians, as you mentioned, on the doorstep. But one of the big changes happens to be with China, which traditionally had what people in our business call a minimal deterrent posture. They had a small number of nuclear weapons, and they seem to be content with that. And they now seem to be acquiring a lot more nuclear weapons. And the Biden administration, like the Trump administration, has made some overtures to China about the possibility of entering into arms control discussions. And the Chinese answer has been a very clear, not interested. And we're not interested because you have a lot of them, a lot more than we do. And so we're just going to go about our modernization plans, and you have no real right or standing to tell us that we should do anything other than what we are doing. And I think getting back to the broader issue of the NPT conference and the future of nuclear nonproliferation, one has to wonder if we are at the verge of an inflection point. That you're quite right. There were predictions back in 1960 that we would get to the point where 25 or 30 countries would have nuclear weapons. That didn't come about. It wasn't through just dumb luck, but a lot of diplomatic effort and handholding. But many people suggest that if Iran, for example, gets a nuclear weapon, the knock-on effects are going to lead other countries, particularly the Saudis, maybe the Egyptians, maybe the Turks, to also acquire nuclear weapons. Likewise, we have talk that if countries become concerned about the viability of any American security commitment, come to doubt either the capability or the will of the United States to live up to its alliance commitments, that those countries, think South Korea, even Japan, might come to decide that they need to develop a nuclear option themselves. And then you get into the question of what are the consequences of those developments for the existing nuclear powers. Again, China certainly does not want to see Japan acquire a nuclear capacity or South Korea acquire a nuclear capacity. If they were to do so, what are those ramifications for security and stability in East Asia? And those are really big questions. And I think we haven't seen requisite level of diplomatic progress to try to grapple with some of them. Fact is, things could change and could change very, very fast.
Well, we'll see about this Biden-Xi conversations. One of the things that would be great to come out of it would be an agreement to hold, quote unquote, stability talks. You know, the Chinese aren't ready for arms control talks, but it would really be great if we could at least begin to get our, you know, some sense of what they're thinking about there. Why are they punching those holes in the ground? We have no understanding about why they've suddenly shifted to this. But you're right, it's a very frightening thing out there. And the Japanese are watching very closely. The South Koreans are watching very closely. Everybody's watching very closely. It is a much more unstable time. And Putin is, you know, there threatening, and at the same time, he's very protected by those weapons. So let's revive arms control.
Well, you're quite right, Carla, about how Mr. Putin views things. I think one of the concerns many analysts here in the United States have is how Joe Biden has handled the veiled or not so veiled threats by Vladimir Putin to use nuclear weapons. And the concern is that this is, in fact, emboldening the Chinese, that they now realize or have drawn the conclusion that the United States is reluctant to get into nuclear brinksmanship. So if China has a bigger nuclear force, it can use it as a shield, essentially, to take Taiwan. And at the end of the day, the United States will grudgingly accede to that move. The counterfear, of course, is that if that's the conclusion the Chinese draw, it may be exactly the wrong conclusion to draw, that the United States, if faced with overt Chinese efforts to invade Taiwan won't back down because they would assess that as being essentially a threat to the credibility of American alliance commitments around the world, but also a threat to the American economy, given what it would mean not just for Taiwan, the world's biggest manufacturer of semiconductors, but also what it would mean for countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia, big part of the global trading network and a big part of American supply chain. So again, we are dealing with a very tense situation with a lot of potential ramifications if one or both sides makes the wrong choice.
Well, with that happy thought, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected Putin cuts gas flows.
Yes, Carla, what our audience has taken note of is that Mr. Putin is weaponizing natural gas sales. He's showing that Western countries aren't the only ones that can engage in economic warfare. Russia can as well. Gazprom, that's the Russian state-owned gas company, said on Monday that it would cut the flow of natural gas through its pipeline to Germany by half. Now, flows of gas to Germany through these pipelines had already slowed. So with the new cuts, the amount of gas in the pipeline is only about 20% of capacity. That has both immediate and long-term consequences. The immediate consequence is that the cost of natural gas, which was already up, has gone up even further all across Europe. And as we know here in the United States, higher energy prices hurt the broader economy. So it's a big ripple effect here. Now, not all European countries rely on Russian natural gas as much as Germany does. Before Russia invaded Ukraine, Germany got more than half of its natural gas from Russia, and natural gas, I think, accounted for something like 20 to 25% of all energy production in Germany. But Germany is Europe's economic engine. So if the German economy slows down, so will the wider European economy. The longer-term fear is that Europe won't have enough natural gas to heat itself this winter. Summer is the time when Germany and other European countries build up gas reserves so they have enough on hand when demand soars as temperatures drop. But gas reserves this summer in Europe are very low, sparking fears that Europe will face an unprecedented energy crisis this winter, one that may lead it to abandon Ukraine. And that seems to be the point of the Russian strategy. In essence, we can inflict enough pain on you by withholding natural gas that you cry uncle. Now, the European Union understands this is the nature of Putin's gambit, and hence we have this EU-wide plan to ration natural gas so enough is on hand come this winter. The proposal is to cut use of natural gas by 15%, even has a name. It's called Save Gas for a Safe Winter. Apparently, everything has to have a slogan these days. Now, there was the plan that the EU proposed, and there was the plan the EU adopted. And let's just say the plan that got adopted got watered down, and it did so in good part because it opened up old wounds within the European Union. Spain was particularly critical of the original proposal, with one official saying that, and let me quote her here, contrary to other countries, Spain hasn't been living beyond its means in energy terms, end quote. This was a very clear jab at Berlin, which had opposed bailouts to countries across southern Europe about a dozen years ago during the debt crisis, arguing that those countries, Spain included, had lived beyond their means, and now it was time for them to be morally upright, tighten their belt, endure austerity because they had been profligate. So get a sense that the Spanish officials very much liked being able to take that jab at Berlin.
Especially because it's going to be a lot colder in Berlin than it will be in Madrid.
It certainly will be, though Madrid can get mighty nippy in the wintertime. But again, this gets us back to this bigger issue of whether or not Western unity in the face of the Russian invasion of Ukraine is sustainable. We saw remarkable rallying of Western support. Ivo Dalder and I wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs talking about why that happened and why Mr. Putin got the West wrong. But again, the Ukraine war wasn't a sprint. It is turning out to be a marathon. It's likely to be a war of attrition. And the Kremlin's bet is that it can endure more pain for a longer time than the West can. We'll see if he's right.
And what's your bet?
I think we underestimate the ability of the West to absorb pain. And I think that Western solidarity is more likely than not to persist. Though, of course, a lot depends upon the decisions that individual leaders make. And do they handle the inevitable diplomatic and domestic challenges that arise? I would say to this point, they have, and I think they will continue to do so. But again, choices matter. Skill matters. Leadership matters.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Saudi Arabia's LIV, I hope I got that right, Golf Invitational Series holds an event at the Trump National Bedminster Golf Club in New Jersey. China assumes the presidency of the UN Security Council, and Germany ends its purchases of Russian coal.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. We love the feedback. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Rafaela Siewert with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia engineered this episode. Marcus, thank you very much. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Morme Zanke, and John David Cobb. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Carla Robbins saying so long.